So just to maybe recap a little bit.
Are you going to do this?
What we talked about. Oh, yes. Thank you. I'm tired again. Okay. Yes. Let's do this. Let's begin properly. With the refuge of peace. So, if you please join me. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami.
This completes the three refuges. Please join me for the 10 precepts. Panyatipada Vrāmi sakāpidāṁ samādhiyāmi. Ādhinagāna Vrāmi sakāpidāṁ samādhiyāmi. Kavesu nityacāra Vrāmi sakāpidāṁ samādhiyāmi. Musa vāra Vrāmi sakāpidāṁ samādhiyāmi. Sura mureya Maja Kamalana Rami Sakapadam Samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from sources of livelihood that bring harm to other beings. I undertake the precept to refrain from acting out ill will or taking satisfaction in the misfortune of others. I undertake the precept to be open-hearted and generous in all my relationships with others. I undertake the precept to act with loving kindness and compassion in all my relationships with others. I undertake the precept to live with mindfulness and practice the Eightfold Path through daily meditation, study, and reflection. Thank you. With these 10 precepts, virtue becomes a vehicle for a happy existence. Through virtue, good fortune is attained. Virtue is the vehicle for liberation, so let us purify our virtue. We dedicate the merit accumulated here today to the benefit of all beings. By this deed, may all beings come to know a pure world, free from suffering. Please join me. May all beings be free from suffering. May all beings be free from ill will. May all beings be filled with loving kindness. May all beings be truly happy. Thank you. Yeah, so I'm going to see if I can begin just to recap a little bit of what we talked about at the close of the evening last night. We were looking at the doctrine, one of the three characteristics, the no-self characteristic, which was in fact the second teaching that the Buddha presented after his own awakening, and which he presented in the form of providing the five aggregates as a complete description of an individual person, and suggesting that as a practice that one should investigate five aggregates. First of all, to satisfy themselves that it was indeed a complete description. And then secondly, to determine whether or not there was any self to be found. Any abiding self, which is a single, enduring, separate entity that
would be the thing that would correspond to that thing that we hang our notion of selfhood on. In the course of that discussion, what always comes up is when you discuss self and no self, in the time of the Buddha and us now, are questions to do with where do we come from and where do we go when the body dies, which are questions that the Buddha basically said were a waste of time, because he wanted you to focus on becoming enlightened in this time, in this lifetime, becoming awakened in this life. And what is clear from the Buddha's teaching is that the fact that we aren't the separate self we think we are is extremely important. And so when we try to understand that, we have the need, and in spite of what the Buddha said, we have the need and the desire to address these questions of what happens at the end of life and where do we come from and so forth. So we'll acknowledge from the outset that we're not going to follow the Buddha's advice very strictly on that. But the important point is, considering that the Buddha said, forget about what happens after death, and the most important thing for you to understand is you are not the self that you think you are. That's where we want to go with this, is to examine the significance of that and not get bogged down in questions of, well, what about all of these other doctrines and ideas? Okay? And in our discussion last night, and when you think about this, you encounter some internal resistance. It's a difficult idea. As a matter of fact, at first glance, it's an absolutely outrageous idea. Because we could just about say the one thing that we are more thoroughly convinced of than everything else is the reality of ourself. And the Buddha is saying, yep, and that's the problem. So we need to look at it in that context. And the characteristics of the self that we think we are is that there's only one of us, and that it has some quality of endurance, and that it is separate, which is this very clear distinction. And actually, I will suggest to you that the third point is the most important one, is the notion of self has no meaning at all without a boundary that separates self from non-self. So really, the most fundamental idea behind self is separateness, which, turn it around the other way, the most important idea about no self is non-separateness. And that's where we should approach it from. The Buddha did say this dharma that he had seen is very hard to understand, and so we're going to have to expect to make a little effort. But it's not hard to understand because it is extremely complicated. It's not hard to understand the way calculus or nuclear physics is. It's not hard to understand the way a lot of modern philosophy is, things like that. It's hard to understand for the simple reason that it requires us to change some of the very basic assumptions that we are operating on. That's what makes the Dharma difficult. And this notion that we are a separate self is a perfect example of that. And it's right at the core of the Dharma. If we have the opportunity to go into these things a little further, what will become clear is what mind does is divide, that is to create separations. This is the most fundamental activity of what we call mind, is to create separations. Anybody ever had that thought before? But does it resonate with you? Do you see? I mean, we were talking about looking for sensations that change with the breath after lunch. It became easier to do if you have a system in which to divide things up and categorize it. This is how your mind works. Mind divides things up, creates separations, creates boundaries. Doesn't matter whether they're real or not. They're extremely functional. It's very valuable to create boundaries. And so it is the nature of your mind to see separation. And one fundamental duality that it immediately sees is there's me and there's not me. There's self and there's other. That is, of those three characteristics of self, that's the one that's striking to the root of the whole problem. If we look at the others, that we want to have a single self and we want it to be enduring, we actually find that that's not really what we're concerned with. But because we assume the quality of separateness, it pushes into thinking that there must be only one of us and that it has to be an enduring thing. Because what the mind has done, what the mind does when it creates separation, is it makes the self into a thing. And what is it that really makes us balk at the idea of no self, forgetting our worries about what happens after we die? What is it that makes a hiccup in your thought process when you try to digest the idea of no self?
Yeah. I wouldn't exist if there was no self the way I think there is.
Well, you wouldn't exist. That's right. But the things that are missing there that... See, I would say it's uniqueness. It's the quality of uniqueness. And it's continuity. The reason we want an enduring self is we need to account for continuity. We feel like we've always been the same self. Well, we feel like we've always been the same self because we've already had this underlying supposition that the self is a separate thing. And so it's the continuity that we're after. And anything that doesn't account for continuity is not going to be a model of reality that we're going to be comfortable with very much, right? Yes?
It's also said that some sort of meaning or order, like if I don't exist, then it puts everything else into question.
Well, the first step in creating an ordered model of the universe in your mind is to divide it into self and not self. Yeah. So, yeah, that is a very, that's the fundamental first step in creating order. Is that what you're getting at there?
Oh, yeah, you asked earlier, what kind of fear does it create? And that's what came to my mind.
Yeah. That's what came to your mind, yeah, right. Especially if you use words like, and you didn't say, if I'm not the self that I think I am, you said if the self doesn't exist, if I don't exist. You didn't even say if the self doesn't exist, you said if I don't exist. Now that is a really confusing place to be. I don't exist, right? Whoa. And so let's just get it straight. That's not what we're saying at all. Because the Buddha said, you exist, you're an individual person, but you consist of five aggregates, and there is no abiding self in those five aggregates. That's what he said. So, the five aggregates exist. At least from the relative point of view that we have to start understanding things from. It may turn out that they're not what they appear to be, So you are an individual person. Those five aggregates, and so as far as that goes, we're pretty solid. But in terms of making sense of the universe, yes, your mind wants to have that distinction between self and other, because for the sake of organization, for the sake of order, for the sake of planning actions, for the sake of evaluating circumstances and various possibilities. And that's really getting to the crux of it there. Yeah.
There's also the problem that, in the way that my mind has worked, I've never experienced like someone else's thinking or eating. Like, I haven't experienced that boundary for, you know, the majority of my life, or maybe when I was little before my mom was like, this is yours, this is your sister's, this is your brother's, you know, before that. So just having that kind of, there's no, up until, you know, there's no experience that would confirm that there's, you know, besides sharing ideas or food, or I can think about air and water, things like that, there's not an experience of unity. It's usually an experience of isolation.
Yeah, but what I hear you saying is, if we're going to trash the idea of self, we've got to replace it with a model of the way things are that accounts for that.
Yeah, that was another problem.
Yeah.
Or not problem, but kind of
like... Yeah. We've got to account for the fact that the only mind that any of us experiences, the only consciousness, is our own. And we make an inference that, you know, I infer that you're all conscious and have minds because of the way you behave. Yeah. And of course, right there, okay, well then there is this difference. There's me. There's this perceiver with consciousness and a mind, and then there's these other beings, and whether they're conscious or have minds or not, they look like they do. And that's not really what's important. What's really important is that there's a subjectivity to my experience, and it needs to be explained. We need to make sense of it. Non-separateness, when it comes to non-separateness, the flip side of being a separate self, then we have to ask the question, well, why is it that I don't know what's going on inside Paul's mind? Why do we feel separate? Why does it seem that we closed off the way we are?
I think all of this is just pointing towards how strongly habituated we have been to the self, to an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And we're attached to it more than anything else. It is the most concrete thing that's in our perception.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody's going to take that away?
Yeah, right. Not only that, if you haven't already, you should ask yourself, even if it's an illusion, why would I want to give it up?
Yeah. Just because it functions. It's not broken. It functions,
yeah. Even if it's an illusion, it works. And it does work. Look how well it works. Look at this world. How well it works. Look at exploitation, greed, warfare, hatred, avarice, various forms of cruelty. Where does all this come from? It works. It works because the notion of self that makes people rich. They accumulate a lot of wealth for themselves. And the notion of, and the separateness of self from other allows them to do it in a lot of ways that allow them to do it in ways that are quite exploitive of other people. And, yeah. So it works, but it doesn't work that well. It is broken. It functions though. Yeah.
You were speaking on the thread of the self and continuity.
Mm-hmm.
Can we return to that, please?
Yeah, well, we need to account for continuity. We do. The question is, really, what the challenge is do we have to posit the existence of a separate self in order to account for continuity? And that's one of the things that we'll have to explore. But, you know, what I'll say is that no, we don't. As a matter of fact, jump right, instead of doing this linearly, we'll just jump way ahead, okay? And that is that we think in terms of causality based on separate entity, on things, thingness. And we try to formulate our understanding of causality based on things. But it turns out that on the one hand, it doesn't even work. I mean, that's one of the little logical games that Nagarjuna played with people to try to persuade them to think more clearly, is that things can't exert a causal influence on each other. He wasn't saying there's no such thing as causality. He's saying there's no such thing as things. Buddha taught impermanence as another one of the three characteristics. And impermanence doesn't mean that things arise, stay a short time, and then pass away. Ultimately, impermanence means there are no things. But actually, there being no things solves the problem that Nagarjuna pointed out. Logically, it's hard to figure out how things can have causal influence on other things. But if there are no things and there is only process, we solve the problem. The continuity can be accounted for. And so that's really where we want to get to in our evaluation of the necessity for the separate self. Do we need to have a thing, an entity, called the self to account for continuity? The answer is no, we don't. We don't have to have that. We don't have to have a thing. We don't have to have a self. We can still have continuity. Your five aggregates are part of a causal process, as they appear to be. And that's a very functional idea. Causality is a very functional idea. It's the separateness that functional but broken. Same thing with uniqueness. Your five aggregates have the property of uniqueness, which if we examine the five aggregates, that's one of the things that we will find. One of the things that we'll look for in terms of trying to find a self in the five aggregates is where is there uniqueness. And there is uniqueness in the five aggregates. I don't know how much you've thought or studied the five aggregates, but offhand, anybody know which of the aggregates possesses the quality of uniqueness?
Perception.
What's that?
Perception.
No, it's mental formations. That is the aggregate. In each of you consists of five aggregates, and in each of you, what really distinguishes you as individuals is the aggregate of mental formations. Which really gets into the whole thing of karma and all these other things. You are that accumulation of mental formations that operate. Each of your perceptions is actually generated by your unique set of mental formations. So that's where we really find the uniqueness. So we've got uniqueness in the five aggregates, and if we regard them as process rather than, or if we ascribe continuity to process, causality as process, we don't need to posit thingness to account for it. And as a matter of fact, logically speaking, we're better off. It's much cleaner. Yeah.
But then, it's a process of what? You know, like, what's the stuff? Like, even if you think, oh, you're more like a river than a rock.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you dive within that, then you would have
Well, we're always going to be stuck with the way our mind sees things. And our mind sees things. We're going to always be stuck with that.
saying how we have a tendency to go toward, okay, well, then it's all energy, but that is even still a thing that would, in our mind, have different frequency, and there would be variability within that process of, like, I don't know, my mind does this kind of stuff, you know, like, in some kind of visual, but I still feel like it's a different form of saying, identifying little parts and pieces of that process. So, I
guess I'm curious if you could you speak to what that process is. Well, what we can say about it is that the more carefully we examine, the more we find that process is a better explanation than things. Okay? As to the nature of the process, or the nature of the process in itself. Here's where we run into the problem of emptiness. We can't know that. It's just simply not possible. All we can know is whatever model our mind can make of process. Okay? So we can't really know the process in itself. But what we can do is try to make a model, a mental model of reality that utilizes process rather than think. Okay? And in doing so, there's kind of a similarity between models and metaphors and analogies and things like that. We'll use a lot of metaphors. You know, we use a metaphor of a river as compared to rock, to help us understand the difference between things and process. But of course, when we look at a real river, what our mind does is it breaks it up into a flow of a bunch of separate things. We can't help that. Our mind's always going to do that. But at the level of metaphor, river works really well. But that's the trouble with models and metaphor. If you look too close, they fall apart. Okay. Yes.
It's very apparent with the actual techniques that you've been teaching us. If we take the walking meditation, so the heel of the foot, the middle of the foot, the front part of the foot, we keep labeling, and at some point you are working faster than the speed at which you can talk in your own head. So you have to discard that model because it's not going to work. At some point you're feeling 50 different sensations in one step, and there's no way you can label them as you go through them, so all you can do is be in that moment, you know?
That's right, yeah.
And the same thing happens in the sitting, you know? The beginning of the breath, the middle of the breath, and the end of the breath can just take you so far because you are going to start thinking a lot faster than you can say those things in your mind.
That's right, and the more closely that you focus on the sensations of the breath, what you're going to find is they keep dissolving into a finer and finer flux until you reach the limits of the limits of what you can distinguish. But that doesn't mean you've reached the limit. And that's actually where these things came from. I mean, the Buddha didn't sit there smoking his pipe and come up with a philosophical theory about process. It was the realization of impermanence was experiential, fundamentally. And this is what we try to replicate in our meditation. We push our perception to its limits, and we find that the sensations of the breath dissolve into a sort of vibratory phenomenon. And we know that that's not as far as it goes. And ultimately there are no individual components being linked together. It is process. And by inference, we realize that that's all there ever is anywhere. What's true of your conscious experience of the breath is actually a reflection of a truth that describes the breath as well. And what describes the truth of the breath describes the truth of everything, including the entire unknowable world that you perceive in the same way that you do the breath. You perceive the breath through sensations. Right? We perceive the whole world through sensations, and the sensations are mental objects. And the mental objects are discrete entities, but they're discrete entities that are reflections of something that is that's not the system of entities in its ultimate nature. The interesting thing is that modern physics finds this. Modern physics of particles is just a way of thinking of things. And it was the first way we thought of things, because that's the way we see our world. So as we bored deeper and deeper and looked at finer and finer degrees of resolution, we kept breaking things up into smaller and smaller particles. But until at some point it becomes apparent that the description of a universe of particles is not really accurate. I mean, even long before we got that, we found that we had to posit fields and forces and all kinds of other things. So we're doing the same kind of research in ourselves to come to this place of understanding that Hui Neng, the sixth patriarch of Zen, said, ultimately there are no things. And that's the truth. There are no things. Things are a fabrication of mind. And one of the things fabricated by the mind is a separate self. So let's get back to, okay, what are we going to gain by this? Why should I give up this idea of self? What are we going to gain? Well, first of all, the self is problematic. I mean, we're starting from the point of the second teaching of the Buddha. The first teaching of the Buddha was the Four Noble Truths. He said suffering is caused by craving, and craving is rooted in ignorance, and ignorance is ignorance of impermanence and no self. Okay? Stated a little differently, craving arises because we believe we are a separate self. Does everybody understand how craving causes suffering? Is that clear? I would hope so. You're all pretty sophisticated practitioners here. So if you understand how craving causes suffering, then do you understand how believing you're a separate self causes craving? I mean, craving, desire and aversion are an absolutely inevitable consequence of believing you're a separate self. It's just inescapable. If that notion exists in your mind of being a separate entity, you have to operate from a basis of craving. So the problem with believing you're a separate self is that you suffer. Not only that, but you cause enormous suffering to other beings as well. So the benefit of being able to discharge the idea that you're a separate self is that you won't suffer, and that you won't create suffering for others. And that's one of the benefits. But there are others too, which we should look at. If we look at the path to no self, and recall what the Buddha said about this path, it's good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. We look at the path to no self, and we can see the goodness that it brings. Part of the path to no self is the practice of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy. Those are the first three of the divine abodes, the Dharma Viharas. Loving-kindness. Loving-kindness is an enormously rewarding thing. Loving-kindness is acting as though you already knew that our separation of the cells was a delusion. And it is an important part of the path to no self, is to practice loving-kindness. The same thing with compassion. If you look at sympathetic joy, everyone knows what I mean, but this is where you genuinely feel happy when somebody else is successful, when somebody else experiences something good, that you share in the joy of others. That's a real bonus, right? The more joy there is in the world around you, the more happiness and satisfaction that you have. And as you know, Shantideva said that all suffering in the world is a result of trying to make ourselves happy, and all the happiness in the world is a result of making others happy. Do you believe that? Does it make sense to you? Anybody doesn't believe that? That's almost surprising, but there's nobody that doesn't reject that. But that just shows what a great group you are. You really follow.
What about the aspect that you're one of the other selves that you need to take care of, too? So, for example, if I'm starving, mm-hmm. and then there's one other person on that, you know, if you create this horrid scenario, I wouldn't even know how to go through the moral, horrible gymnastics. I don't know what that, mm-hmm. like, in those kinds of situations.
But yeah, you are, while you're in the place of perceiving the world as being made up of separate selves, you do have to see yourself on an equal par with everyone else. No. That's what you're getting at there?
Yeah.
Right. Because making yourself less than everybody else is another form of conceit. There's really three forms of conceit, a little bit different. One is thinking you're better, more important than other people, and that's what we do when we meet our needs at the expense of others. That's what we do when we inflict pain and suffering on others in order to satisfy our own anger and so forth. Then there is the conceit of thinking that you're less than others. This, being a doormat is a way of reinforcing your own ego construct. And we all know people that do that. Being depressed is a way of reinforcing your own ego construct. It's a very self-centered point of view. The whole point, poor me. It's a kind of conceit. It's doing the same thing. It's reinforcing the ego concept. In a slightly different way, even thinking you're the same as other selves is still a conceit, because it's not a conceit in terms of the importance you attach to yourself in terms of others, because you're seeing as equal, but you're still seeing yourself as separate. And so that's the sense in which it's still a conceit. But it's far better than the other two conceits. As long as you see the world in that way. And that resolves some of the problems that we might come up with. Trying to keep precepts, practice the perfections, practice the Brahma Viharas and things like that, is how do we evaluate this psychophysical entity with respect to all these other psychophysical entities? And the thing is, you have to treat this one as equal to the rest. You have to be the mother who loves all the children equally, including this one. Yeah. That's the place you have to put yourself in. Yeah.
So, getting back to what you said about the benefits of attaining no self, which is basically true happiness. So, when you achieve that, one of the things that I think, I know that I have a problem with, and I think maybe other people do too, is thinking that you think, okay, once you've attained that, well, there's nothing there to enjoy it. So, what you're saying is, there's definitely something still there to enjoy it, because the opposite would be nihilism.
That's right.
It's just not us as we are now, and we can't really understand it until we're there.
That's right. We're not the sense itself we think we are. We're not. But that doesn't mean there's nobody there to enjoy it. As a matter of fact, the experience of a Buddha who dwells in no self is complete experience.
One of the problems, I think, you were talking yesterday about how there's kind of like a lower scope when it's any Dharma is taught and a higher scope, is that we keep thinking about Buddhahood in terms of the best we can offer in samsara. So we keep saying Buddhas are love and compassion, but love requires hate because it's a samsaric thing. They're doing something other that we can't understand. Is that correct?
No, I I when you make the statement that love requires hate, I don't understand that at all. I can't really.
Well, if we live in a dualistic system, every aspect of the system has a counter move. So when we're talking about love, when I say love from my dualistic perspective, I understand love because there's hate. I don't understand love on its on the absence of hate. So at the end, it's a samsaric thing that I have to let go of too, because that love is not ultimate love, if we wanted to use a word to categorize it as different, you know?
Yes, well, what you have to do is to gain a new understanding of love. It's like, well, there's love as sexual desire and attachment. You'll make me feel good about myself, and I'll make you feel, so we've got a contract, you know. I'll take care of you, you'll take care of me. That's kind of love. And that's not really love at all. But it's, we use the same word, love, to describe it. And hate is really, hate has nothing to do with real love. Now, yeah, you're right. There's different ways, there's different levels of seeing things. So at the most worldly, at the most ignorant level, then at that level, we see everything as pairs of opposites, and we might make statements that you can't have love without hate. But I'd like for us to operate from a little higher, more sophisticated level of understanding. But maybe we have to do some work to get there. In just in terms of having a group discussion where we get there. We use these words like love, what do we mean by them? And I told you yesterday, to me, love and consciousness and shared receptivity are all words that are making reference to a single principle that pervades all of reality. It's a universal principle. So now we have a language problem. When I say love, that's what I mean. But when you hear love, maybe you hear something different. Even the idea of loving kindness, though, is we're saying to practice loving kindness, even though I experience myself as a separate entity and I experience you as a separate entity, I'm putting myself in your place. And putting you in my place. I'm exchanging myself with you. And this once again, we're back to the practices that we use to move ourselves in the direction of no self. So loving kindness is different than all those other more selfish forms of love. It's where it may not be a love that's beyond self, but it is a love that where myself is interchangeable with yourself. Does that help too?
Well, yes, but I think it takes us back to this creation of a new model to take over the one that is broken. And a part of it is that a lot of the language has to be defined.
Yes, you're absolutely right. That is the problem. The language has... We have to redefine all these words that we're using. And in a way, isn't that what this whole process is about? We're building our models, our conceptual models of reality in our mind. Words correspond to concepts, so when we redefine the words, we're redefining the concepts. And more sophisticated concepts are built up out of simpler concepts. And so some of this is going to involve recreating our conceptual model is going to involve rearranging which concepts we link together to form some more sophisticated ones. Yeah.
Would your definition of love have something to do with the relief of suffering rather than the opposite of hate?
Would my definition of love have something... Well, yeah, you see, hate is coming from a place of selfishness that it's saying that myself is so important that just satisfying my aversion towards you justifies my destroying you. Right? So it's just, it's an extremely extreme version of selfishness. So there's no love in that at all. There's absolutely no love in that. That's the way that I think of it. That's why I really have to go to a different place to see hate and love as opposite. Love is this one thing, and hate is this other totally different thing that doesn't even bear any relationship to love.
And his model of love and hate being the same thing, and his love being different than your concept of love, or them being opposites, it seems more like they're the same thing, like aversion and craving are just both craving but operated in a different way. So if hate is, if there's an energy and it's pleasant because you do what I want, that same energy, just in a different way, if you don't do what I want. So, it doesn't seem to be love at all.
That's right.
They seem to be the same thing.
Yeah. That's right. Desire and aversion are the same thing. They're just different forms of the same thing. And there's no love in either desire or aversion. Although, interestingly enough, desire can give rise to love. That's what we do. We get together out of desire. And if we're lucky, we learn to love in the process.
But to sort of remove the specifics of love and hate, I think one of the questions that comes up is this duality versus beyond duality. So we have things that we hear that we say, like, you wouldn't be able to know what light is if you had never experienced dark. You can't understand happiness unless you had suffering, and then the suffering was taken away. So, is there a model where there is happiness and love, and there isn't, it's not known in contrast with the opposite of it?
Exactly. That's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to come to, and this is where I was trying to direct the conversation, is the problem that we need to see, is it possible to create a model that doesn't require an entity that is a separate self? And, of course, if we do that, if we continue with the development of our model, we want our model to also become one that doesn't have the duality of love and hate, and so on and so forth. Yes, we're trying to get a completely new model. And this is the question, this is the challenge. The Buddha is saying, essentially to us, that this is possible, that that the human mind can function from the basis of a model that is not resting as the foundation on the duality of self and other. And that is a question. We need to know if that's true or not, right? Otherwise, we're not just wasting our time. Well, you laugh, but it's true. We would, we need to assure ourselves
that it's true. Conversations like that I've been part of conversations like that.
Yeah.
If suffering's, always dependent, if happiness and suffering are always interdependent, then
we're trying to do the impossible, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's why I was saying that it's a new nomenclature. Mm-hmm. Because when we're talking about any two things in a holistic system that is part of samsara, and we're trying to escape samsara, when samsara is escaped, you don't take anything from samsara with you.
Exactly, that's right. But while we're dealing at the level of samsara, we've got to move in the right direction. So we're trying to build a model together, and words stand for the concepts that we're building our model out of, so that we're going to have to redefine our words in some degree, or at least have a much deeper understanding of our words as we go along. So I agree with you totally. That is true. So do you think it's possible for you to have a model of your identity as an individual person that doesn't rest on the concept of a separate self? Got that one head shake, two head shakes, one nod.
I believe that
we need to have an ego that's healthy to relate.
Yeah.
And it's, as you were saying, it's invaluable. It's the basis of sanity in an insane world that I can tell the difference between this and that and you and him and me and everything else. I mean, it's the basis of...
Yeah.
I would be... have to be locked up in some place where I couldn't hurt myself if I didn't have a functioning ego.
Yeah.
But the crucible of these practices, I see just going in the quiet and seeing where the idea of craving covers both pushing away and grasping, pulling towards. It covers both of them. And who's doing that when I say, oh, I'm at odds with my own experience? I'm just sitting here at odds, suffering. In the moment, by some grace, that dissolves for a moment. I see, oh yeah, this model, and I don't know what the hell you'd call that, walking around terms, but it is possible. We get glimpses. I think that's the whole reason why I put up with this. It's hard. But I see that, like, there are glimmers, there are cracks in the...
Yeah.
And the broken system that my ego's formed around itself, mm-hmm. and had a lot of help formed around it, right. from the culture and everything else coming from the outside. I don't know what the hell you call it, though. Mm-hmm. A healthy version. I wonder, like, how you, when the bell goes off, you come to so quickly. I don't know where you were. And then you get up and walk, and it's like... Just got it together. I mean.
Well, there's some very good points there. Your mind works the way it does for very good reasons, and we haven't really talked about emptiness, but granting that both that cup and that notebook are empty, you'd be a mess if you tried to drink your tea out of the notebook. And the same thing is that if we have a model of an operating model of who we are in relationship to others, it's still got to allow us to keep our laundry separate from everybody else's, right? Yeah, it's absolutely essential. And you know, if we couldn't do that, we'll go back to this other place, and it may be an illusion, but it works, so don't mess with it. The only reason that we'd be willing to mess with it at all is that it's still going to work at least as well. No, to even bother making the change, it's got to work better. So we have to work on a model to see if possible to have a model of reality that allows us to do this. Now you're really asking a question. Is it possible for human beings to actually become awakened, enlightened? Or is this whole thing just a fairy tale?
Isn't the working model then that of Bodhisattva?
In what sense?
In the sense that you're trying to live for others, to help them?
Yes, as a matter of fact, okay, in that sense, it is. Yes, you're saying you're the whole point of trying to think like a bodhisattva is to try to alter your internal model to be a little bit less selfish. Yeah. In the same sense that a really big step towards that still falls far short of realizing no self, but a really big step in that direction is to see yourself in others and others in yourself. To exchange yourself for others and to see yourself and others as equal. If you're still in the delusion. You're still in a place of separateness. But you've certainly weakened the dynamic that drives suffering and that drives the kind of behavior that creates all kinds of unnecessary suffering, right? So, and the same thing, you say, I'm a bodhisattva, I'm going to try to achieve awakening for the sake of all beings, I'm going to try to liberate all beings from suffering. And of course, the reality is that there's a whole lot of your time when, you know, that's not really a part of it at all. But you have it there. You keep calling upon it. It's your reference. And by working with it, you start, you move more and more in the right direction. Yeah, it's true. You're never going to be, you're never going to be free of the sense that you are a separate self until you become a Buddha. That is the defining event. That's what makes a Buddha separate from a non-returner, which is the stage and the path that immediately precedes Buddhahood. That is the defining difference. So, yeah, you're going to still have that perception that you are a separate self, but you can modify the model that you carry around. But what forms can that take? But in just really practical terms, how can we, are there ways that we can look at things that help us? Models that, you know, the model's not the reality, granted, but are there models that are much closer to where we want to be than where we are, and can we use them as a basis for operation? And that's really what we need. That's what we're after. So the degree that we can, to the degree that you can understand intellectually the truth of no self, you're modifying your internal model for how you perceive reality. If you cannot understand that intellectually, then you're pretty much stuck using the same model you've always had. And so that's why it's so important for us to work on understanding these things. That's why the Buddha gave as his second teaching the practice of investigating the five aggregates. And by the way, have you done that practice of investigating the five aggregates in search of an abiding self?
Similar. We do a lot of body-mind, is it in the body, is it in the mind kind of meditations, is it outside the body-mind complex, is it...
Yeah.
That sort of thing, but not as much as the five heaps.
No. Well, what's really useful about that is that it guides you in being able to look at other things. Like, for example, all the things that are interrelated in here, as I said yesterday, everything in Buddhism is interconnected, so every place leads to everywhere else. The five aggregates themselves, if you begin to examine them, they lead you into dependent origination. I'm losing my train of thought here. Where am I going? Fatigue setting in. Okay, I'm going to have to finish this up because my brain's not working. So, emptiness. And from understanding of emptiness, there's an understanding of karma. And from an understanding of karma, then we have a tool that we can use in a really constructive way for changing our internal models. So what is the direction that we would want to take this with? If we have the time and I have the mental clarity. I think probably the next place to go with it is if you can... Well, what I would have liked to accomplish tonight was for you to be really clear that it is feasible to construct mental models that don't require separation. And that's one of the things that had we time, we could have looked at and using the analogy of a river as a process. Yeah.
When you say it's feasible to build these models, are you referring to the already existing models that we're studying here, or are you referring to some kind of personal version that somehow brings those models closer to our way of living and thinking? Or are you referring to, you know, the models that we are of Buddhism?
Now, I'm talking about the model you create in your own mind for which you're going to use models in Buddhism. You're going to use good models that other people have already constructed to create your own model. But the only model that really counts is the model that's operating inside your mind. That's the model that determines what you see when you open your eyes. That's the model that determines how you react to something when it happens to you. And so that's the most important model. So the models we talk about are the models that you read about, are the models that other people create. That's helping you, so you don't have to do it all from scratch. And it's guiding you, so that if your inner working model is leading to some undesirable result, you can figure out what's wrong with it and tweak it. So, yeah, so many things I would like to describe this. Use the metaphor of a river so that you can see that processes can function as though they were separate entities while still not being at all separate. And I think that's a very helpful notion. And it is a metaphor, but it's a metaphor that helps you create a working model in your mind that isn't so firmly attached to the idea of the necessity of separation. So maybe I'll try that just briefly and we'll see if it gets anywhere. Okay, so we're standing by the River Ganges. It's half a mile wide, smooth as glass. Right? We have some dye guns, okay, that inject dye. So we're going to stick our dye gun into a place in the middle of the Ganges, underwater. We're going to inject some dye and going to watch where it goes. And what you see is as the dye moves downstream, it defines a current within the river. Right? And we put another squirt of dye in and we'll see it follows the same path. And so we can say with a reasonable level of confidence, there exists a current in the Ganges that goes here and there and so forth. It looks like that. Every time we put another squirt of dye in, it follows the same pattern. Now we'll go over to a different place. And we'll do the same thing. And we'll see that there's a different current. And yet another place. And we'll see there's yet another current. Now, do you believe that there are invisible boundaries dividing the River Ganges up into a discrete number of currents? And out of pure luck, or maybe omniscience, we always put our dye gun in the middle of one of those distinct pre-existing currents? Yet, nevertheless, you look at the patterns of the dye as it flows, and it's defining something. It's defining something that is real, right? And actually, there's an infinite number of those, no matter where in the Ganges that we stuck our little dye gun, we would, quote, discover another discrete current. And it's fun. You can define your current over there, and I'll define my current over here, and we'll watch, and sometimes they come over, and they almost touch, and then they go apart. So that shows us that discrete boundaries are not necessary. They're absolutely not necessary. It's just a metaphor, but maybe it helps us loosen up somewhat the way we think about things. And And we could play with this a lot, you know. We could stand on a bridge over the Ganges and we could drop rose petals, and you could drop red rose petals, and I'll drop white rose petals, and they'll float down the river on their own currents. And our bridge is the eternal present moment. And as we stand there looking at our trails of rose petals down the river, we say that's the history of our life. Each rose petal is one of those memories of what was once the present moment. So what I hope is that in some way you can see how thinking in those terms loosens up the hold that I am a separate self has, the idea that there's no way that I could construct a working model of reality that would allow me to drink tea out of a cup instead of a notebook and keep my laundry separate from yours without believing that I am a separate, discrete self. And also without throwing out the notion that there is causal continuity in this entity and that one and all these others, the same way there is in the flow of the river. The causal continuity is there. Not only that, the uniqueness is there. There are no two places in the river that are going to produce the same current. Everyone is absolutely unique. So we have our uniqueness. And we have our continuity. And we don't have to have boundaries. And we don't have to have separation. We could just play with this metaphor just a little bit more and realize that we used our original squirts of dye to plot out the current. Now, as we watch it go down, one of the things we see is that our dye ends up, at some point, it's dispersed in the entire river. We can't see the current anymore. In other words, all the water is mixed together. As a matter of fact, from the very first moment we squirted our dye in the water, it began to mix. The water making up the current is never the same. And it's not separate from everything else. It's constantly interchanging. Having mapped our little current, we can take our dye gun down the river to a point in that current before it all disappears, and make another squirt there, and we can see it continues on. The fact that the water mixed, and the fact that our dye got mixed in all the rest of the water in the river, didn't mean that the current ceased to exist. So the current has a kind of reality itself that's totally independent of the water that's flowing through it, or the dye molecules that we put into it. The current, yes, the current would be the five aggregates. And in a sense, I mean, we could talk about this, I'd love to talk about this in more detail, but the way that I would put my metaphor together is that four of the five aggregates are like the dye and the water. You know, they're coming and going, and they're constantly interchanging, and they're never the same twice. The aggregate of mental formations, though, which is where all the karmic formations lie, that's more like the rose petals floating on the surface.
So you said four of the aggregates were the water and the dye,
mm-hmm.
but you didn't use the word current.
Four of the aggregates are the contents of the current, the constantly changing contents.
Okay.
Right? There are things that, you know, we're thinking of this current as an entity in its own right, even though it has no boundaries. But what makes it up is constantly changing. And so four of those five aggregates, the consciousness, the feelings, the perceptions, and the sensations, constantly changing, appearing, disappearing, they don't belong They don't really belong to your aggregate. They have nothing to do with your five aggregates' uniqueness. But if we understand how the five aggregates interact with each other, we'll see that there is something, there's an important continuity that's different than the continuity of the other parts of the aggregate of mental formation. The way that you're going, the way that you're going to have form a particular perception is the result of it is a mental formation, but it's a mental formation that's created by other mental formations, right? The feeling that you have in response to a particular event, it feels pleasant, it feels unpleasant, it feels neutral, is at least partly determined by the contents of the aggregate of mental formations. An event occurs, and based on your past experiences, your accumulated karma, all the different ways that you think of it, a particular feeling is going to arise. Now that's completely transient, comes and goes. We look at the stream that is your five aggregates, and pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, pleasant, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, 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 all feelings come and go, come and go, come and go. There's no sameness at all to them. Same thing with perceptions, come and go, come and go. Sensations, come and go. The sensations are the rupa aggregate. Come and go. Consciousness, eye consciousness, ear consciousness, tongue consciousness, eye consciousness of red, eye consciousness of blue, tongue consciousness of salty. Come, go, come, go. No one lasts more than a moment. They're like the water molecule. But there is something in the five aggregates that gives it a particular quality that makes it different from all the rest. Maybe you could call that the current. What is the current in the river? It's a particular convergence of energies, of forces, right? What is it that causes water as it flows down to follow a particular path and to more or less keep reproducing that over time? All these different forces and energies are interacting and they're converging and they're creating this. Really, in a sense, the current itself might correspond best to the aggregate of mental formations, which is like karma. Your unique karma. So that's how we can play with this metaphor. But remember, it's a metaphor. There's always going to be a point at which we'll push our metaphor too far, and it won't work. It'll fall down. Right? Try to put one more card on the stack. It only works up to a point. And of course, when you reach the point where it falls down, you can always try to think of a better metaphor that allows you to build further. And that's good to do. But the point is, I guess really what I wanted to do tonight when I came in, sorry it was such a roundabout way of doing it, was to make you understand that you don't need to be wedded to the kind of mental models that you've always had. And that separation of the attributes of the self, this most defining of all attributes, separateness, boundary, is totally dispensable. So if you can understand that, we've made some really, we've accomplished something good. Does that make sense to you? Mm-hmm. Follow me on that? Mm-hmm. And that's, yeah. Yes, go ahead.
Intellectually, I think, you know, most of us agree with the possibility of considering boundlessness. But the challenge...
The possibility of...
Of conceiving the absence of boundaries.
Yes.
But the challenge starts, as Michael was saying, when you start seeing objects that are separated, and it's so obvious that they are, you know, single objects. Mm-hmm. Is that something that we address through meditation? That type of sensorial experience, which is so hard to deny, mm-hmm. is that going to be broken by meditation, or is there something in addition to that, that we should be practicing.
Quantum physics.
Mm-hmm.
Quantum physics has already broken that.
Yes.
We go through life with an understanding of physics that was taught to us in high school that is incorrect.
Yes.
And we believe it as true.
Yeah, but do you live by quantum physics?
Yes.
You do? All day, every single day?
The thing when you... Sorry. Quantum physics, just a massive revolution. It's just breaking down Newton physics. When you see a particle behaving either like a wave or a particle depending on the way you observe it, it's just crazy. Yeah. And when you see quantum entanglement, it means that there is no time and space for particles. That time and space is just a construct of the mind.
Yeah, but still, you don't, you know, that means you need to get a PhD in physics.
No. You don't need a PhD in physics. You just have to watch a visualization of what do we know. But just at school, we are taught from a young age Newton physics, and we think we have a matter existing independently from us. But since a young age, you educate people, and I'm not saying with quantum physics, you plant different seeds.
In physics and in science, every time we come up with a new theory, it's absolutely essential that the new theory be able to explain everything that the old theory did. And to do more than that. So each new theory has to be able to do everything the old theory did, and to do more, otherwise you wouldn't have a new theory. The same thing with a new model. It's got to be a model that works better. It has to work not only as good, but better than the model that you had before. But what happens in our meditation? Our meditation allows us to operate with a better and better model. Ultimately, what our meditation does, though, is bring us to the place of knowing with absolute certainty that all we will ever have is a model. And that's the most important thing. Because your mind, that's all your mind can do, is create a model of reality and operate on the basis of that. And so to be awakened is to have a mind that is still operating on the basis of a model. As a result of the work you've done, it's an incredibly superior model to what's commonly going around. But it's still a model. What makes you awaken is that you know it's a model. There's absolutely no moment at which you think it's anything other than a model.
I've heard Professor Thurman say the same thing, as Buddhahood is the ultimate tolerance for cognitive dissonance.
Interesting way of putting it. Yeah.
And that, you know, it's kind of weird to walk around in silence and not look at anybody. My girlfriend's right there. I can't look at her. But I see my mind make these stories about it, all of you guys. You know? And I just know I haven't even said two words to 98% of you. I don't know you at all. So all the time I'm going, I don't know where that came from, but I have no basis for that overlay at all. You know, so there's this constant muscle of disbelief being worked, both in the meditation, particularly if I want to get out of suffering with whatever I'm trying to push away or pull towards. But also when I open my eyes and I look at everybody else, I'm like, all those labels are just coming up. I don't know. They have no basis in the object at all. It's just the disbelief muscle that keeps you working at this point, it feels like.
What do you think about the idea that an awakened person doesn't relate to reality with models at all, that they're maybe, I guess, like drink water and stuff like that, I don't know, but that their mind is directly, like there's no model making that's like abstractions or whatever.
What do I think of the idea that an awakened person operates with no models at all?
Because to me it seems that like any model we have, like this, a separate self, enduring self, is like a model. Mm-hmm. And that earlier when you were talking about process, and she was saying, what is the process or whatever, is it like energy or something like that? It seems like we're always like trying to make a model, and that reality never conforms to our models, and it seems to be the problem in the first place. And there's like a model, and at least like we're usually attached to it, and there's like a protector or defender, it's incongruent with some other being's model or something. So to me, it was seeming that like the whole idea of like a model was like the problem to begin with. Like they're useful, but our investment and attachments is the problem to begin with. So I was thinking maybe a Buddha just dropped.
Well, when a Buddha is dwelling in Nirvana, there are no models. I mean, Nirvana is a cessation of the mind's model-making process, right? And so if you, let's picture Buddha sitting in meditation in Nirvana. And from that place, Buddha is functioning from a place of no model making at all. Okay? But what about when Buddha is walking around and talking and teaching people and sorting his laundry and things like that? Right? So there's a way of describing that. Okay, which is to say, the mind of the Buddha dwells in Nirvana, but the body and speech of the Buddha functions in the marketplace. But even so, the body and speech of the Buddha are functioning from a highly superlative model, but it's still a model. Okay? It's a highly functional model. That's the marketplace. So as the Buddha is walking around, teaching, eating, doing his laundry, and everything else like that, to say that the mind of the Buddha dwells in Nirvana is to say the Buddha knows that the ultimate truth is that none of these models are real. None of these models are ultimate truth. And ultimate truth is that the models are not real. At the same time, models are operating. Buddha is operating on the basis of models when he speaks and when he acts in the world. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I heard something like that you said earlier. You said Buddha is when you drop the models. Okay. You were talking about the difference between a non-returner and the Buddha, and then you started talking about models and things like that, and I thought there's like a discrepancy.
So, through the process of meditation, we gain insight into the truth, and we, through the study of the Dharma, through understanding the path and following the path, we create better and better models. So that when we become a Buddha, we'll operate from a more or less perfect model. It will be a model in which the Bodhisattva ideal is upheld. That everything the Buddha says and does is for the benefit of all beings. Because that's the operating model. And of course, you may have come into this confusion: if everything's empty and the Buddha knows everything's empty, then, what's he doing? Going around teaching people, how does he know what to tell them, so on and so forth. So the Buddha is dealing with everybody else on the level that they're at, which is models. And it's only when the Buddha gets tired of doing that and he lies down on the hammock spread beneath the trees at Kusinara and says, "You're on your own, boys."
So there still is a duality between ultimate and dependent reality. I mean,
that's right,
But there's
ultimate reality, and everything that is a part of dependent reality is a part of dependent reality. So in a world where there's a Buddha walking down the road, that Buddha is a manifestation of dependent reality. But if you take reference to the Yogacara three realities, mm-hmm. there is the apparent reality that's entirely false. There's the dependent reality, and then there's ultimate reality. The Buddha does not need the first of those. The Buddha can't dispense with
dependent on each other and things like that.
What's that?
And that would that be the place where suffering and happiness are interdependent? Kind of. I mean, referring to the earlier question of.
Well, the interdependence of suffering and happiness are an illusion, and the apparent nature is no reality at all. Okay, so the interdependence of suffering and happiness it's not a part of dependent reality or of ultimate reality. It's only a part of the apparent illusory reality, which is no reality at all.
It's very clever to make it into three, because two is problematic, because we're always like, it's deceptive reality, but not to Buddhas, because they're not deceived by it, and there's this big semantic thing.
Well, that's exactly why they laid it out that way.
Okay.
Exactly, because...
Just make another reality. I love those Yogacharyas.
Well, I hope this was helpful. I wasn't at the top of my form again tonight, but and so we can move on into other areas tomorrow night. Yes?
I think we all benefit from your presence, so I hope you will stick around and keep teaching us.
Okay. If that's what you want. If you'd like to take a washroom break, something like that, and then we'll sit together till the bell rings. We have 30 minutes from this point to sit together.